hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome today students from Judah Public School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Deerfield High School. Thank you for coming. And these students are attending on their own time. Why aren't you in class? You need not answer that.
That's right. You can have a lawyer if you want.
Thank you for coming. That's very kind of you. The students are here with us because we invite high school classes to come to Troy and hear an oral argument, and then a visit with a justice who will talk about the procedures of the court in hearing and deciding cases, not about the substantive issues of the case they are about to hear. This is a national award-winning program, and thousands of people have attended these court proceedings. Everyone is invited to attend the session with the justice at noon today, or I should say after the first class. So let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack, who's the justice with whom the court will meet, whom the students will meet today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call the first case. Now, is there anyone in the courtroom who does not have a summary or is not aware of what this case is about and would like a summary of the case? If so, raise your hand. It'll be easy if you understand this case if you read a summary. Do the two students from Deerfield have summaries of the case? Okay. Everybody else? Thank you. Okay. 04AP276, David Zastrow versus Journal Communications. Mr. Demet, you have 25 minutes to argue on behalf of David Zastrow et al.
Good morning. May it please the court. Welcome to the eighth year of the Journal Communications stock litigation. I'm not sure that's something we can all be proud of, but that's where we're at. I'm attorney.
The statute of limitations doesn't apply to that.
I'm attorney Kevin Demet, and we represent the plaintiffs. Thomas Frem is here from Petrie and Stocking, and my brother Donald Demet, and we've represented the plaintiffs since the outset of this case. Where we prevailed to some extent in the trial court and were reversed on appeal. The plaintiffs purchased stock in the employee stock plan at Journal Communications, known as the JESTA. And the stock plan was administered from a trust document that was located at their corporate headquarters at 4th and State in Milwaukee. And the primary testimony of most of the witnesses of the defendants was that nobody was really reading this trust, not even the trustees. And because if they had followed that trust document, we probably wouldn't be here today. Nobody, when these employees were terminated, nobody knew their age, their years of service. The trust was basically like the Ark of the Covenant. It was out there, but nobody ever looked at it. Maybe there was a fear of something, I don't know. Even when the trust was amended, it was a confidential document which amended the trust to describe the terms upon which an employee could retire. One of the themes I want to emphasize for your consideration of this case is that trustees have a duty to read a trust and follow the terms of a trust. Beneficiaries do not have a duty to read the trust. They can be ignorant, and very often they are ignorant. They don't know the terms of the trust. They don't know what terms apply to them, and they rely upon the disclosure and information provided by the trustee.
Counsel, if one of the employees wished to get a copy of the trust and to review the terms and condition, was there any prohibition against that? Was there any problem in getting a copy?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure the factual record was clear on that. All of our claims that we made in this case, except for breach of fiduciary duty, negligent breach of fiduciary duty, were dismissed in the trial court. We made contract claims. We had no right to a jury trial. This was a bench trial on one theory and one theory only, negligent breach of fiduciary duty.
I've got another question. Do you think that you really can have a negligent breach of fiduciary duty? As I read some of our cases, it seems to me that the case law, and I'm talking especially about Beloit and Wormka, would seem to indicate that if there is a breach of fiduciary duty, it's an intentional tort. So how can you have a negligent breach of a fiduciary duty?
Very frequently you have it. It's a misapplication of the terms of the trust in a negligent manner. You had it in the Hattelberg case, which I believe Judge Prosser wrote the opinion. But essentially what you have is a trustee negligently failing to fulfill their fiduciary obligations. What fiduciary duty is a standard of care. And it's a higher standard of care than what the ordinary person on the street has. That's what fiduciary duty is. And you can clearly have negligent fiduciary duty. I don't understand how a case from England can change the general context of the law. You had it in the McCoy case. You have it in the Hattelberg case. You have it in the Noonan case.
Do you think Hattelberg really decided that issue?
I think they did. I don't think you could have had a judgment as a plaintiff in the Hattelberg case without a finding of negligent breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, the Court of Appeals said that Hattelberg caused it to pause, if you would, in regard to what the law was, but they came down accepting Beloit as the law in Wisconsin. And I would read Beloit as basically saying that if you have a breach of fiduciary duty, that's an intentional tort, not a negligent tort, no matter what you call it in your pleadings.
Well, that presents some enormous problems, because if you're a beneficiary of the trust and a mistake is made by the trustee and you can't pursue that, there's no incentive whatsoever for the trustee of that trust to
pursue it. You just have to do it within the statute of limitations. Isn't that correct?
No, because the standard of care will be that the trustee intended to harm you. And if that's the case, that's virtually impossible to prove. You basically have to prove theft.
Counsel, why can't you just proceed on a breach of contract action? The beneficiaries are clearly third-party beneficiaries of the trust, and the trustee is a contracting party for the trust. Why can't you just sue them for breach of contract? They don't follow the terms.
We did it. We did that. We filed that. That was one of our claims, and the trial court threw it out.
You didn't bring that to us, did you? That's not before us. You didn't appeal that decision, did you?
Well, we appealed we didn't file this appeal. Mr. Schreiner filed the appeal.
Sorry. Okay.
We got judgment.
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
all right.
So let me ask you then, because my colleagues are bringing up some things in the trial court. Now, in the trial court, you pursued an intentional tort claim. Am I correct? What did you, in the trial court, what did you win on there? Pursued an intentional tort claim at trial, just so I've got this correct.
No, we pursued negligent breach of fiduciary duty. The trial judge...
Throughout. I just want to get my facts straight here, so okay.
Throughout the intentional acts. So, and what we had basically is a trust document that said these people had the right to sell their stock within 10 years, and we had secret administrative amendment to that trust, which was adopted by Tom McCullough, the chairman of the company, in 1977, which prescribed new terms for how you could retire. And what it said is the issue was not at that point whether you had a pension when you left the company. The issue was whether you were age 55, had 10 years of service, and agreed not to work anywhere else in the future. And that particular document is a trustee minute from 1977, which is stamped confidential and is part of the trial court record. And so the employees in this case who were terminated
So I gather that's your answer to Justice Crooks's question. Your answer, that would be your answer, you're emphasizing confidential. Your answer is that no employee, if they had asked, could have gotten that document. Is that?
In this case, when I asked for the document, I got it. It's sitting on the table here. It's stamped confidential, and it's redacted. Portions of the document are deleted so that we can't even read them to this day. And that's the central document that defines retirement. So we're down to four people who recovered at trial, and these were the four most ill-informed people. They basically knew nothing, because anybody that even knew there was any possibility of 10-year retirement, what the judge basically found in the trial court, you better figure out a way to get the 10-year retirement. And that's problematic, because Mr. Kaler wrote at least two documents to the employees saying, you have up to 5 years to sell your stock, in writing.
So if we were to agree with you that there's a negligent breach of fiduciary duty, how do you get out of Section 33 in the trust document?
I read 33 in the context of the whole document. You have to read Section 34. And under Section 34, it clearly states that there can be a liability of the trustee in the bona fide discharge of their duties. And what I think the trust was trying to say is that essentially we're not going to give personal liability if you've been bona fide in the discharge of your duty. However, the trust assets are still responsible for complying with the trust. And that's all we've ever asked in this case, is that the trustees be compelled to use the $1 billion trust fund to pay the claims of these people, which is what we're down to, is about $200,000 of claims.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I have one more thing on that. And I assume you weren't sincere about it because you didn't mention it just now, but in your brief, your reply brief, I guess it came up, you asserted that this kind of a clause, Section 33, wouldn't fly under ERISA, but you're not claiming that the trust is an ERISA trust, are you?
That was never briefed. The issue, I think, is this is violating public policy. The trial court found that Mr. Schreiner's interpretation, the defendant's interpretation, would violate public policy because it leaves no remedy whatsoever for a trust beneficiary who...
But that wasn't my question. My question to you was, you are not claiming that this trust is an ERISA controlled document, are you?
We claimed it in the trial court, and the judge rejected it.
Okay. Before us, are you claiming it?
No.
Thank you. That clears it up.
No.
Let me just see if I can try and state some law. And then, Mr. Schreiner, if you're going to do the oral argument, you'll have to see if you agree with my statement of the law. One, you can have an intentional breach of the trust with the elements of an intentional tort. You can have a negligent breach of fiduciary duties. That, if I understand now, I'm going to your argument, maybe. If there's an intentional breach, maybe the two-year statute applies. Maybe. Even though the two-year statute, let's see which one's 2 years, 57, 893-57. It's an action to recover damages for libel, slander, assault, battery, false imprisonment, or other intentional tort to the person, right?
To the person, and that's clear.
It's a kicker language. So you would say that even if it's an intentional violation, it's not within 893-57 because it's not to the person. But contrary to your argument, just to set out the law, as you got several cases that seem to say that regardless of whether it's an intentional violation of trust, fiduciary obligations, or negligent violation, 89357 applies, right? I mean, you've got law that says...
The Loeb case is one, and the Loeb case is really the problematic case.
I think if you track back from Wonka, you have cases that say that, too. They seem to treat it as a per se intentional tort under 89357.
None of them involved express trust, but they did.
Okay.
They did.
I'm just trying to set out the framework for discussing it, and if I'm wrong, then you're... Okay. Your claim here is negligent violation of the trust. So your claim would be it's not an intentional tort. It should come under negligence, which is 89343, right?
Well, that's the
contract
one. I actually think the most applicable 52? Is 52. It's an injury to property.
Meaning their economic interests. Okay.
Personal property.
There's another one you could use, which is the general liability statute, which is 6 years, right?
That's correct.
Okay. That's 893.93. You could fit under that because there's no other one that correctly does that. So if the court were to accept your argument, this is a negligent claim, not intentional claim, then to determine the statute of limitations, do you always have to look at the cause of action particularly? And if you claim intentional and negligent, you might treat them differently? That's the bottom line after I got to all of that.
I think if the Beloit case, and the court didn't have to make a ruling in the Beloit case on statute of limitations because preliminarily the court found there was no fiduciary duty to the claimants in that case. And then it went on in later language in the case to say that statute of limitations applied. In this case, we have negligent acts. The trial court, we're not at the claim stage. Now we're post-judgment. The trial court findings, which are entitled to deference, they say negligence. Court of Appeals in a footnote says, we read the whole record, and in a footnote says it wasn't negligence. It was intentional acts that you proved. I don't understand how we got to that point, but that's how we got within the Beloit case analysis. The Beloit case, the reason the claimants in that case did not pursue any negligence claims is because they couldn't. There's no way you can pursue a corporate officer and director for negligence. You have to assert intentional acts. It's true because of the business judgment rule, and it's true because of 180 of the statutes, which prohibit negligence claims against corporate officers and directors. Those areas of the law do not prohibit actions against trustees for negligence, and they shouldn't, because trustees should be held accountable to comply with the terms of the trust. And if they aren't, it's going to present huge problems going forward, and this Court of Appeals opinion is very troubling. I'll give you a hypothetical here. And let's say I'm the trustee for a mentally retarded person, and I misapply funds, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and that is not recognized for more than 2 years going forward. That person will never be able to recover under the analysis of the Court of Appeals in the Zastrow case. And that is very troubling and problematic.
Find this hypothetical. Let's say I'm an attorney sitting in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. I have a nice law office. Right next to me is this little bar called the Cozy Bar. That's in the next case. And I draft a will. And I do some estate planning, and I have a trust that's part of the estate planning, and the client says, Mr. Attorney, I want you to be the trustee. So now I'm the trustee of this trust in the estate planning process. And let's say and then people die, and the beneficiaries aren't happy with the attorney trustee. And trustee, there's a fiduciary duty there, you know, and so they sue the attorney trustee. Would the attorney's professional negligence carrier cover that?
It depends on what the policy says. Sometimes the policies say we will cover you for your fiduciary duties. In other words, if you assume a fiduciary duty, it's a voluntary act to become a trustee. You sign a document. And some of the insurance companies in their standard form cover it. Some do not.
Some would cover the intentional. It is intentional or not.
Most would not cover intentional
acts.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what I was going to. That, right. So you're professional. If you serve as a fiduciary, that is a trustee of a trust in an estate planning document, and you get sued, it's not handled under your professional negligence. It would have to be a specific provision that addresses the issue of trustee.
Right, and some policy forms cover it and some do not.
Counselor, are you claiming the breach of fiduciary duty arises from the failure to follow a provision of the trust or from the failure to give notice of the opportunities available to an employee under the terms of the trust?
Both.
Okay, so you're saying, okay, tell me which paragraph they didn't follow, and tell me which paragraph you conclude they should have given notice of.
Retirement is defined as leaving the company with a pension. Under Section O, that's a subsection, but it's in the definition. Retirement shall mean the separation of an employee from the employment of the employers with a pension granted by any of the employers or under provisions of a pension trust or trust established by any employee of the employers for the benefit of the employees. Everybody left with a pension. What happened is Perry Printing had a defined benefit plan. They converted it into a cash plan, a defined contribution plan, and that's the plan that people had when they left, which is a 401k, basically.
Okay.
So they left the company with a pension, and they didn't get the 10-year sellback. What they got was a modified sellback schedule. That doesn't arise out of a trust document.
That's my question to you. You said that you were claiming both they failed to follow a provision of the trust and they failed to give notice of an opportunity to an employee under the trust. And I guess I want to know what provision did they fail to follow?
Provisions allowing the beneficiary the option to continue to hold their stock. They forced the sale of the stock. That's the way this program works. They sell it for you automatically. The company sells the stock. The employee doesn't do anything. The company automatically sells the stock. That's the way the plan works.
Thank you.
Is the issue of negligence before us?
Yes.
I mean, that is to find what acts were negligent. Is that before us?
There was a finding by the trial court that the trustees acted negligently in a couple of ways. First of all, you have the letters from Bob Kaler saying, essentially, and I attached them in my reply brief, giving a shorter sellback schedule. Now, in order to go against Mr. Kaler, you would have to assume that, you know, he was wrong about the trust. The employees are sitting there in Waterloo, 60 miles from Milwaukee.
What I'm trying to say is I don't see in the briefs anyone arguing whether it's negligent or not, or that the trustee properly or didn't properly perform. They're arguing, and maybe I'm wrong, that's why I'm questioning you. The argument is, assuming for the moment there was negligence, aren't you barred by the statute of limitations?
That's correct.
So, for purposes of this case, if you win, what happens? You go back for a trial?
No. We had a trial. We had a judgment. It gets reinstated.
The judgment is reinstated. And in the judgment, there was a finding of negligence. Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
That's not challenged.
Could I ask, if assuming you can have a tort of both intentional breach of a fiduciary duty and negligent breach of fiduciary duty, and plaintiff's counsel had the option to choose, when would you choose one and when would you choose the other?
Well, you mean strategically, how would you decide to do that?
Obviously, there might be a statute of limitations factor, but what would be the benefit of choosing one or the other? How are they distinguishable from each other?
The ability to recover punitive damages, which you would get in a, if you can prove intentional conduct. It's more of a theoretical thing because the fact of the matter is it's extremely hard to prove. But the other benefit of asserting negligent breach of fiduciary duty is that it's an insured loss. And you have another deep pocket, which we have in this case. The insurance company is one of the defendants. So those are the kinds of considerations. And, yes, statute of limitations is one of the considerations. It is.
Now, you can have all these fiduciaries out there with errors and omissions with not coverage, you know, professional negligence coverage, with not actually having coverage for fiduciary obligations if it's deemed an intentional tort?
That's going to be a real, that's a potential problem because you have a standard clause in insurance companies' policies saying we're not going to cover intentional acts. So if you start coming in and the only kind of claim you can make is an intentional acts claim, it may be uninsured. And that's a problem for trustees.
If this case had been brought within the 2 years as an intentional tort, there would have been the possibility of punitive damages?
Theoretically. It's very hard to prove intentional acts. They put up the defense that you would have expected. We didn't read the trust. We weren't really thinking about these people. That's the defense. And that's the defense we expected.
What's the elements of an intentional tort? Do you remember them?
A duty and an intentional violation of the duty and damages. I mean, that's the way I'd summarize it for an intentional tort. But you've got to have an injury to the person. And I don't see that here. We never alleged it. We never proved it. The trial court never found it. And we can't delete words from the statute because we want to get the defendant knocked out of court. And I think what's happened is the Court of Appeals has deleted, blue-penciled, words out of the statute. They've deleted the word intentional. They've deleted the words to the person. And that was the only way they could come to the conclusion they did in this case. And we can't – it's Mr. Schreiner's burden. He represents the defendants. They come in. This is an affirmative defense, meaning the burden is on the and the obligation to prove it is on the defendants. The Court of Appeals, in the way the decision is written, they reversed the burden of proof. They basically put it on us and said that we had to prove the inapplicability of the statute of limitation, and that's not the way it works.
I don't think that's quite right. Didn't they say that the claim was a claim for an intentional tort? And then whatever statute of limitations follows from negligence or intentional torts are what you end up with.
Yeah, we're not at the claim stage. We're post-judgment. So
I understand you're post-judgment, but the judgment was based on a claim for negligence, right? And that would give you one statute of limitations.
That's right.
All right. And if you have a claim for intentional conduct, you get another statute of limitations. And though the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, it is up to the plaintiff to prove the claim, correct?
Yes, but trust law is a little different, too, and it's in several respects. In other words, as a trustee, you have a burden to show that you've properly administered the trust, a primary burden. And Mr. Schreiner and I have had proceedings in the past where he's gone first, even though he represented the trustee. I remember in the Walter David Talmadge case, Mr. Schreiner represented the trustees, and they had the primary obligation to go forward and prove that they had administered the trust appropriately, accurately, and consistent with the terms of the trust instrument. And there's case law supporting that. So there's a general tort law burden to go forward on the part of the plaintiff, but then we have this whole trust law issue, which sometimes trustees get to go first and have to go first to prove that they followed the terms of the trust. And, you know, the trial court did not agree with me on that issue, but that's one of the motions I made prior to trial, was that they had to go forward with the burden of proof because they never showed to the court that they administered the trust consistent with its terms. I see the red light is on. Are there any more questions? I suppose I should save them for rebuttal.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Schreiner, representing Journal Communications, Inc. et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the Court. I listened to Mr. Demet's description of this case at the beginning of his statements, and it's not a case that I recognize from having tried it. Secret amendments and things of that sort are not in this case. That isn't what this case is about. I mean, you might start by looking at what Judge Alsvik thought the case was about. We've got his opinion. It's in the appendix. And I almost don't know where to begin.
Well, let's begin with the law.
Yeah.
Can you have a negligent violation of the trust?
I don't think you can have a negligent breach of fiduciary duty, if I can rephrase the question. I think that a trustee can be guilty of negligence. Trustees are guilty of negligence all the time.
Right, and they're lying.
They improve investments. They hold on to dot-coms for too long.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So
That's not... I think methodologically, that's not a breach of trust claim. That's a negligence claim. And I think it's important, and I hesitate in Mr. Demet's presence to cite English law, but I think it helps. Breach of trust, fiduciary, you know, the Latin word, faithful, is something where you are unfaithful or disloyal. It is by its very nature an intentional act. It's a bad act. A trustee can, of course, be negligent. And if a trustee is sued for negligence, has to defend himself or herself against that, is subject to the 6-year statute of limitations. Isn't the claim that was made here. It was never made here. It was never made in the amended complaint. And I just want to, just to get this case back where we are and what we actually tried, direct the Court's attention to the paragraph 71. It's on page 35 of our brief, the blue brief in this Court, right in the middle of the page, and I state at the end of the previous page, and I'll state it again, that in this amended complaint, the plaintiffs allege that the trustees engaged in misconduct. They pleaded no negligent breach. They didn't even suggest a negligent breach. And I quote the language, this is what this case was about. The forced sale of said units at an inadequate price was a deliberate, willful, and wanton act in reckless disregard of beneficiary rights under the contract, etc. That's the claim that they brought to Judge Alsvik. That's the claim that they tried. He threw out lots of the case before we got to trial. Justice Rogenczyk, your question, he threw out the breach of contract claim, for example. That's no longer here. Also, you asked, you know, what did you accuse the trustees of violating the terms of the trust? They did indeed. They made this argument about retiring with a pension, and they said everybody was a retiree. Even if they were 25 years old, they were a retiree under their interpretation. He threw that out. That's not here anymore. This was a claim, and he was candid to say, because they were looking for punitive damages, where they pleaded breach of fiduciary duty. Judge Alsvik recognized that. And he, when he ruled in the case, having rejected our idea and said there could be a negligent breach of trust, his finding, what did he say is the basis for this? It's on page 14 and 15 of his opinion in the appendix on pages 23 and 24. This is the core of what he found the trustees to have violated. If I can read from the bottom of appendix 23. The court concludes plaintiffs met their burden to prove the defendants, that is the trustees, negligently, he uses the word negligently, but listen to what he held, failed to fulfill this heightened fiduciary duty to disclose the availability of the 10-year sellback as a reason why plaintiffs should retire from Perry Printing when it was to be sold. He had said on the previous page, to lead into that, the court concludes that because the defendant trustees could purchase some of the sold-back trust units, and because the company had contracted to facilitate immediate employment, defendant trustees had a heightened conflict of interests which now imposed on them a heightened duty to disclose the availability. He found an act flowing from what he found to be a conflict of interest. Now, we think he was wrong on that, and I can explain that, and it's actually in our Court of Appeals brief, why there is, in fact, no breach of fiduciary duty here. But what he found was an intentional act, not a breach of a duty in the face of a contract, of a conflict, to disclose. It's like the situation, and this is what breach of fiduciary duty is all about. You self-dealt. You acted faithlessly. You acted in breach of fiduciary duty. That's what it's about. That's what he found. He thought he had to find that.
What does that have to do with the statute of limitations, whether you're negligent in performance, your duty, or you call it a breach of the duty? What difference does it make here?
It has to do with the claim that you're bringing. If you're bringing a claim for an intentional act, that is, a breach of fiduciary duty, then you're subject to a two-year statute of limitations. And I don't know how much of this you want to hear in terms of that's what you said in Wonka and that's what you said in Beloit. You did. And you were right to do it.
What did the jury find?
What did the jury? There was no jury.
The trial court find.
This was the trial to the bench. Judge Ellsworth tried this case.
He found what?
What did
you say?
And that's all he found. He found that they had a conflict of interest, which meant that they had a heightened duty to disclose to these three people that testified that they should consider retiring instead of, and getting 10 years, which a retiree could get, instead of going to work for the new company and taking
some. It's your position that he found an intentional breach of duty?
Yeah, it's our intention that he found a breach of fiduciary duty, an intentional tort.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And his language, negligently failed to fulfill the duty, you think it should just be a
word? He had the word negligently.
Okay.
He had the word negligently. He knew that we were arguing that there was a two-year statute of limitations on a breach of fiduciary duty claim. He had previously ruled, and he adhered to it in this decision, that there could be a negligent breach of fiduciary duty. We disagree with him. We think that's a question of law.
Schreiner, if I could, you mentioned Wonka
right.
and Beloit. I want to go to Wonka because, as I understand that decision, the court held that the two-year statute of limitations governs the intentional tort of bad faith.
Right.
Didn't use the terms breach of fiduciary duty. Now, I understand Beloit does, but I don't see Wonka's going as far as you assert here.
Well, I thought Wonka said, Your Honor, I thought Wonka did actually
use that language. He said that that bad faith is
I think what the court ruled was it's claim for bad faith is for damages allegedly resulting from an intentional wrongdoing by an insurance company, and that action has commenced within 2 years, and then the court then held that it's a two-year statute of limitations because it governs the intentional tort of bad faith. And the reason I bring up the question is because of I think what's been alleged is somewhat of a conflict between Beloit, which I think clearly says 2 years governs, and Halliburton, which at least arguably says something different.
Yeah, I get it.
And I'm not sure. And when I looked at Beloit, Beloit doesn't cite any cases.
Right. I think that is. Wonka does say, and Wonka was a bad faith claim, in paragraph 3 of the decision, the breach of the fiduciary duty is an intentional tort and is a common law recognition of the duty an insurer owes to its insured. So Justice Steinmetz did use that phrase. That, of course, was just a few years after 893.57 had been amended as part of the sort of reconstitution of Chapter 893 to put all the intentional torts in 893.57. And that's where that language and other intentional tort to the person came from. It came in 1979 or 80. It's the same statute you dealt with recently in another case. Justice Steinmetz said, and it is not an issue whether it was 2 years or 6 years. It was an issue whether it was 1 year or two. He said, this is an intentional tort under 893.57. And you can see where he got that because that's what the statute says. Since then, the Seventh Circuit, the Eastern District, the Western District, and I suspect trial courts all over the state, certainly Judge Duda in the Beloit case, have concluded that what you had in Wonka was the breach of fiduciary duty is an intentional tort. It's got a two-year statute of limitations. That's how the case got up here in Beloit in the first place. But let me, before I...
Can I just ask the new position?
You have to let me.
I know. Your position then is you claim breach of fiduciary duty, you're claiming an intentional tort, 2 years goes.
Right.
But you can also claim negligence performance of your obligations under the trust.
And may I demonstrate that?
Wait a minute. Just,
no. that, I, am, right? I am agreeing with it, yes.
Okay. So negligence performance under the trust, you're distinguishing from fiduciary duty, even though, as I see it, there's a fiduciary duty to perform properly and carefully under the trust.
Well, not a fiduciary duty. You have a duty. But let me look, if I may.
Right. Let's just, so.
We ought to get to Heidelberg.
Okay. If you plead negligence performance, then what statute of limitations governs?
6 years.
6 years.
Six years.
If you plead intentional, if you plead breach of fiduciary duty, 2 years.
If you accuse.
If you plead both.
You know, people bring both all the time. One of them is going to be subject to a shorter statute of limitations. If you accuse a trustee of faithlessness in carrying out the trustee's duties, you're charging an intentional tort. Let me use the facts, if I can, of Heidelberg, if I pronounce that correctly, to illustrate this point, because I think it really is an interesting one. You may remember that's the one where the lady was importuned shortly after her husband died to come to the bank and put her finances in their hands. She did it. They sent her, as I recall, I was interested when you were talking about sitting in the bar next to your law office in Blank.
I was talking about in the law office, happened to be in the bar next door. I wasn't in the bar in my hypothesis.
Because my recollection of the facts is that the bank said, you ought to go see attorney so-and-so. He drafts these things. And she said, no, I'm going to see my neighbor, Mr. Duplain or whatever, Duplessis. And she insisted, and you know, he took it out of the form book, and he screwed it up because he didn't put crummy provisions in it, if I remember that correctly. What the court said, and there were claims there both of negligence and of breach of fiduciary duty, is they said, we are not going to decide the breach of fiduciary duty claims here. We would want to have some more facts found on that, but we don't need to reach it. And they analyzed it from the point of view of negligence, and said both it could be a negligent duty to disclose information from someone who has previously disclosed information under 552 of the Restatement of Torts, or it could be a common law claim for a negligent misrepresentation. And went through that analysis and came to that conclusion based on the situation that existed, which didn't have to be fiduciary. It was a professional relationship between the bank and the lady, and said, you know, at least by, I think it was 1988, when you recognized that this trust was bad, you shouldn't have kept urging her to put money into the account, which wasn't going to be tax deferred as a result of the error in the original. And that was negligence. That was negligence. The court didn't look at breach of fiduciary duty. Had it done that, and if the parties had argued it, I suspect they didn't, you could have found, it's discussed in our brief in the Court of Appeals, in the Restatement of Trusts, Section 222, a situation in which there is a duty to disclose, in which breach of that duty to disclose would be a breach of fiduciary duty. And that is, it's the second exception to the duty to the general non-duty to disclose. If a trustee knows that a beneficiary is about to take an act with respect to the subject matter of the trust which will work to her detriment, he has to warn her. That could have been the basis for the same holding in the Heidelberg case. And so, yes, you can have breach of fiduciary duty claims arising out of the same fact as negligence claims. And why do you bring them on? Mr. DeMent was candid. Well, if you can get in time and bring your breach of fiduciary duty claim, you might get punitive damages. On the other one, you wouldn't, perhaps, probably. And, you know, the idea, and I hope I don't need to argue this point, you read Mr. DeMent's brief, and in many respects, he just doesn't like the idea that there's a short statute of limitations on intentional misconduct and a longer one for negligent misconduct. But that's been the law for a very, very long time. That goes back to 1849 in this state. And the idea that the legislature would say there are certain kinds of things that people do, that if they're mad about it, if the victim is mad about it, we want it brought to court then and resolved or forgotten about, put into oblivion, is an old idea. I mean, why do we have short statute of limitations for defamation? Why do we have a short statute of limitations for battery? It isn't because those aren't bad things. They are, in fact, bad things. It's because We want the legislature, which makes these decisions, wants them over with. And it said we want the same thing with respect to other intentional torts.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
If I may. Your distinction, as I understand it, then, you suggest that you can have a cause of action for negligent performance as a trustee, which is a negligence cause of action, and a breach of duty of fiduciary duty as a trustee, which is an intentional tort.
Right.
What are the elements of the negligent performance as trustee cause of action? What do you have to show?
It's not a special cause of action. It's a negligence cause of action.
What do you have to show?
I think it's the elements that Judge Vergeron set out in footnote 12 in her opinion, where she sets out the different elements for a claim for breach of fiduciary duty and the elements for a claim for negligence. The existence of a duty of care, a breach of the duty of care, a causal connection, loss or damage. I agree with that.
Let me then.
Yeah.
So in the way that you see it, in a negligent performance as a trustee, you have to have a duty, right? And just as in your response, and then the breach of that duty. What is the duty of a trustee in the negligent performance as a trustee cause of action?
Well, it might be a duty to make prudent investments. It could not, let me be quick to say this because we're really talking almost theoretically here. It could not arise under the terms of this trust. And by the way, Judge Ellsvig found that they did not misinterpret the trust, that they properly interpreted the trust, because this was a strange trust. It could only have one asset. It was only allowed to hold stock of the oil company.
This is where I'm going.
Right.
And it collapsed. Your argument for me is collapsed, and so I need to give.
Okay.
I need to be uncollapsed by you in your response. The way that you've responded, negligent performance as a trustee is a cause of action in negligence. And referring to Judge Vergeron, you would say that you then need a duty. What is your duty? Your duty is as a trustee. If your cause of action is a negligent performance as trustee, and then what you need, according to that footnote, you need a breach. You need a breach of your duty of trustee, then you need causation and damages. So I don't understand why in a negligent performance as a trustee, where you need to show the duty of a trustee and a breach of that duty, which then is, you say, a negligent cause of action, how that differs from a breach of the duty of a breach of fiduciary duty cause of action, which is an intentional tort.
Because it doesn't involve faithlessness, it involves carelessness, and it's not a special negligence tort that only arises with trustees. It simply recognizes the general rule of negligence, the dissent in Paul's graph that we followed in Wisconsin, which is you have a duty to people with whom you come into a relationship with to act with the ordinary care you would act in that relationship.
But the fiduciary duty is a heightened duty.
It is indeed.
And so when you have, as you say, a negligent performance as a trustee, a negligent cause of action, the duty of the trustee is a heightened duty. So what is that heightened duty? And was there a breach of that heightened duty? And then I just think it's a matter of semantics.
No, the heightened duty only arises if it's a fiduciary violation.
By definition, a trustee is a fiduciary.
Absolutely. But not everything that a fiduciary does with respect to a beneficiary is a breach of trust.
What's your authority for that? What's your authority for saying that a negligent administration of the trust is not a breach of fiduciary duty? I mean, I read the Akron Law Review and about keeping them separate, but I don't know. I don't see a citation that says that the negligent failure to perform the tasks set forth in a trust is not. He can separate that from breach of duty. The way the Akron Law Review does it, it's only a duty of loyalty that's a fiduciary duty. I don't think that's right.
Oh, it's a duty of loyalty. It's a duty of loyalty. It's a duty of impartiality.
What's your
citation.
I do cite that article. I do cite the case it relies on. I do cite the Colorado.
I want to know what in Wisconsin. Oh, they say Colorado is being good because they make the separation. I want to know where else. Does the restatement of agency do it? Does the statement of contract, restatement of trust?
I think it's in the restatement of trust.
Okay. Where?
It's in the section, if I may, because this issue wasn't briefed in this court. I refer the court to it. It's in the section of our brief in the Court of Appeals where we argue that there was no breach of fiduciary duty proved here, which sets forth what a breach of fiduciary duty requires under Wisconsin law and is filled with Wisconsin cases. It's on page 44 to 54 of our brief in the Court of Appeals. No legal duty to disclose information to beneficiaries under the circumstances.
Holberg says a fiduciary, citing Merrill Lynch, fiduciary relationship arises from a formal commitment, we got that,
right,
to act for the benefit of another, right?
Right.
That's here. Or from special circumstances, from the law which would presume an obligation to act for another thing. Determining whether fiduciary is written, that's to arise. So all we have on a fiduciary relationship is a formal commitment to act for another. Seems to me the formal commitment is duty of loyalty, no conflict of interest, and due care. That is all part of the fiduciary. The fact that everybody else in the world also has obligations similar to the fiduciary doesn't mean it's not part of the fiduciary duty. So I don't see what we get from splicing and dicing. Okay?
If I may say, what I think we get from that is clarity. And I think we get something that makes sense for people who undertake to act as trustees, directors, and so on. Because they understand that before they can be found liable for a breach of trust, which is some people still take seriously in this world to be accused of that, someone has to show that they engaged in disloyalty, that they did something intentionally wrong, that they abused the relationship they had with the beneficiary, that they were something other than sloppy. And by the way, that's why we have provisions like Section 33 in trust agreements. That's why we have provisions in trust agreements that say that the trustee can continue to hold what would otherwise be an imprudent asset in the trust. Because the grantor can say, as the grantor said here, I don't want you to bring simple negligence claims against the trustee. And I think that's the dilemma that the plaintiffs are in here, and I think they have brought an intentional tort claim that this court has recognized and correctly recognized that the legislature has treated as an intentional tort. It's like defamation. Defamation, which of course is one of the listed or two of the listed claims in 893.57, an intentional tort, you might breach it, you might commit defamation without being malicious, but you can't do it without being intentional. If you put the wrong name down in the paper, you know, David Smith was arrested for murder, but you put David Simon's name down, I think he's got a claim, forgetting about the constitutional aspects of it, for defamation under common law, because it's an intentional act. It's not something you do sloppily, negligently. And again, these intentional acts can't be exonerated. We all recognize that. Section 33 doesn't purport to do it. Those are the things that are channeled into what we commonly understand as a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and it makes sense. It brings clarity to the law. And the fact that our law is settled and has been for 17 or 18 or 19 years now and that is important. People who are fiduciaries, directors of companies and trustees, who buy insurance like to know when their liability is over with. Do they have to continue to purchase a tail? I mean, there are expectations built up over the fact that this court has so clearly said for such a long period, reinforced it only 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, that breach of fiduciary duty is an intentional tort with a two-year statute.
Counsel, I want to go a little bit to the facts as I understand them, and if they're wrong, I would appreciate your straightening me out. As I understand it, that you are arguing to us is that the plaintiffs have alleged that the failure to give notice to the employees, or the failure, as opposing counsel said, to sell their stock over a period of 10 years,
can only be a breach of fiduciary duty, and it cannot be negligence. And because it can only be a breach of fiduciary duty, the two-year statute of limitations apply. And I think what seems to be troubling some of my colleagues is, why can't that just be negligence, that failure to give notice or the failure, as opposing counsel says, to go ahead and sell the stock over 10 years?
Well, if I may help a little bit with the fact.
All right.
Judge Ellsby said they interpreted the instrument right. These people were not, in fact, retirees. He was correct on that. The question arose, why didn't they tell them that even though they're not retirees, they should perhaps become retirees, give up their seniority and their job in the new place, which some of them testified.
Well, you see this as notice rather than an action.
I see it as a notice that, okay. It's a notice that Judge Ellsvik himself recognized was triggered by what he thought, erroneously, was a conflict of interest in the way that they acted, because he thought, or he said that he thought, that the trustees were actually trading in the units that these plaintiffs were selling back to the company. Now, in fact, that's not correct, and there is no evidence in the record of that. He didn't say that they did. The plaintiff confuses that sometimes. What he said is that they could have. In fact, there were something like 3,000 unit owners and, you know, 10 million units.
I want to get you back to facts that concern me. So you're saying that the failure to give notice is what the trial court found was the wrongful conduct here. And if I recall what you said earlier, you said a certain part of the restatement of trust makes the failure to give notice of, well, it's when you think the beneficiary is going to do a harmful act. There's a failure.
There are three exceptions.
Right.
You have to give, and to get back to your first question, you have to give somebody information if they ask for it.
Right.
You have to prevent them from, if you know they're going to harm themselves in some way, you have to give notice.
Okay.
And if you are going to deal.
Let's stop with the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Because this conduct of not telling them they could sell their stock back over a 10-year period, does that fit within the second exception?
Well, we argue, again, in the Court of Appeals brief that it doesn't, and I think our argument makes a lot of sense. It is not clear to me as I stand here today that these employees would have been better off retiring, giving up their jobs and their seniority. Every one of them testified they weren't ready to retire and didn't want to retire. These were people my age. You know, these were mid-50s people with kids going to college and so forth, and they didn't want to give up their job. And I don't, you know, there are people who take the winnings on the lottery in a lump sum. I mean, there are people who make a conscious and intelligent choice. The idea, I mean, if these trustees, they didn't think about it. If these trustees had said to them, well, we think you ought to quit your job, retire here so that you no longer have this benefit under the contract under which we're selling the company and get the 10-year retirement benefit, and then that hadn't worked out, now there would have been a claim.
Mr. Schreiner, you keep referring to your Court of Appeals brief.
Yes, ma'am.
Which leads me to think, why isn't it in this brief?
Well,
if the issue is before the court. If the issue is not before the court, then we ought not to be talking about your Court of Appeals brief, because the instructions are always given.
Right.
Repeat everything in this brief. So I'm a little confused as to what the issue is here.
Well, I'll tell you why. The Court of Appeals.
Why I'm confused or why I'm.
I won't tell you that.
I haven't done that.
The Court of Appeals had five issues before it, as I counted the reasons why we thought they ought to reverse, one of them being that there was no breach of fiduciary duty to begin with. They reached only the first one. They decided that the statute of limitations had not run. That is the ground on which they ruled. They didn't reach the others. You don't have to get to the others. I'm not asking you to. I was responding to questions about why did I think there was no breach of fiduciary duty here, and simply explaining that we had gone into that, and that issue is one that has to be resolved. If the court reverses on the statute of limitations, there's a Section 33 issue. There's a question of whether or not this is a breach of fiduciary duty. And then there's the sort of gratuitous award of $85,000 in attorney's fees without any authority under the law, which is also sitting in the case unresolved, which has to be gone into either by this court or the Court of Appeals if this court reverses on the statute of limitations.
Okay. So tell me why simply you think the statute of limitations is run without getting into all these other issues that are not before us because then they're not briefed.
Because breach of fiduciary,
You're defending the Court of Appeals decision.
I am.
All right.
They're quite right. They read Hatterberg right. They read Blank right. Breach of fiduciary duty is an intentional tort. And the statute of limitations is 2 years. And all the units and the failure that the Judge Ellsvig thought was a breach of fiduciary duty happened in May of 1995, and this lawsuit was brought in April of 2000. And every unit that any of the plaintiffs who are currently petitioners in this court had was sold by 1997. That's in the record, too.
Counselor, don't we have to agree with the trial, the way you characterize the trial court's finding, that what it found was a, or concluded occurred was a breach of fiduciary duty in order for you to prevail?
I think that you do indeed. I think you have to characterize what he found to be a breach of fiduciary duty, what I call an intentional tort. I agree with that. Mr. DeMette doesn't want to try the case over again. I'm not particularly interested in doing that either. And the ground on which he won is the ground on which I think he has to go forward, and I think that's an intentional tort. Thank you.
Mr. Steiner.
Yes, Your Honor.
If I may ask one brief question. Could you comment about the concerns expressed here about when you have an intentional breach of fiduciary duty, there might not be coverage? I mean, concern about coverage.
I wish I could. What I know is that trustees and directors purchase insurance to cover them for breach of fiduciary duty claims. I don't think it has an intentional exclusion because that doesn't make any sense. And that it is different from the general comprehensive liability negligence type claim. It is a special claim for fiduciaries. The policy that my clients have is a fiduciary claim that covers them for claims brought against them as fiduciaries. That's the one that I think people have been depending on as having a 2-year statute.
Negligent and intentional.
I haven't read the policy, and I can't tell you that, what the policy says. But I hope it covers everything, because I don't know what this is going to turn out to be.
No, the position, if I were a fiduciary, I would want insurance that covered both intentional and negligent.
And it may well do that, and it may well be two different policies. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
And it's not relevant to the statute of limitations.
I don't think it is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Mr. Demick, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. One of the issues Mr. Schreiner brought up was the historic application of the statute, and I'd just like to point out to the Court that even in the Beloit Court of Appeals opinion, in a footnote, what it is discussed is the fact that express trust historically did not have any statute of limitations. Now, the Warnka opinion.
Is the Beloit Court of Appeals opinion the law in the state of Wisconsin?
No.
Okay.
It's a discussion of the law.
So it has significance in that regard?
Well, I think Mr. Schreiner said that the history since 1849 in Wisconsin was that breach of fiduciary duty was an intentional act. That there's no precedent for that. And what I'm pointing out to the Court is, in fact, there was no statute of limitations historically on breach of fiduciary duty involving express trust. And I think there's good and sound public policy reasons for that, because a trustee is going to be held to a higher standard of care than an ordinary person on the street. And that's really what fiduciary duty law is all about. You, as a fiduciary, have a higher duty of care. And if you look at the Hammes opinion, when you're operating under a conflict of interest, it shoots from high to highest. And that's where these trustees were, because they were buying this stock from these people as they were terminating. And this stock had significant advantages to them if they purchased it, and the sellers were losing significant advantages because, in fact, they started to revalue the stock a few months after the employees were terminated. So it meant a lot of money was exchanging hands. It's a billion-dollar company. You ought to be able to read the trust. You ought to be able to put out correct information as to when you should be buying and when are you supposed to be allowed to buy and sell your stock.
Counsel, are you claiming that the information they gave them about this, quote, expanded buyback provision, which as I understand it was 5 years rather than immediately on termination, was a breach of fiduciary duty?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. And the other public policy issues I just want to hit on are the fact that interpersonal healing is not really a defense, and you're going to have people coming, trustees coming to you time and again with the dog ate my homework defense. I didn't mean to do this. I didn't read the trust. And that's just not cutting it for a trustee in Wisconsin. At least it's never been historically, as the cases that I cite in my brief. The Barry and Martin case and all these other cases talk about heightened duties. They don't talk about diminished duties when you're a trustee. And then one of the most troubling things about the trial court, what the plaintiffs were forced to do, and Mr. Schreiner did hit on it, and he hit on it very eloquently, they had to come in and prove that they didn't intend to work anymore. And that's an illegal covenant, and it's an impossible election to put on somebody. And I would say, who of us would be forced to give up our retirement benefits in exchange for a promise never to work again? And that's the secret covenant, one of the secret covenants that the trustees imposed on these people. And I don't see any precedent for that in Wisconsin, and I see a lot of case law that shows the opposite. Is you can't force people to discontinue employment at Walmart, which is Christine Farnsworth Crass's testimony, is that's one of the things they were trying to do, and then they eventually abandoned it but did not recognize, in fact, that the employees of this subsidiary, many of them were, in fact, of sufficient age and years of service to have the 10-year sell back, and they just didn't know it, and they just didn't tell them that they had the 10-year sell back. And that, when they're operating under a heightened conflict of interest, that's a real problem. And so I think fiduciary duty law, it's the standard of care. And the standard of care is way higher than the ordinary person on the street who's driving their car and accidentally bumps into you. This is a big deal. A $1 billion company, you better manage the trust, you better manage it following your fiduciary duties. And if you're buying the stock back, you have way heightened fiduciary duties. And
Counselor, are you in agreement or disagreement with Attorney Schreiner that a trustee can negligently breach the standard of ordinary care, and the trustee can also breach a fiduciary duty of care, and you'd have two causes of action arising out of the same conduct?
Well, we're not a whole pleading state. It's a series of operative facts. You make a complaint. You read the facts of the complaint. Some of the things get tried. Some of them get dismissed. That's what happened here. The negligence claims were left. The intentional acts were dismissed by the trial court.
I probably didn't say it as well as I hoped I had. What I'm trying to get at is you keep talking about a breach of fiduciary duty, and then you also talk about negligence. And what I want to know is, in your theory, are you claiming that there was a negligent breach of a duty that's a fiduciary duty rather than, by the same trustee, a negligent breach of the standard of ordinary care under the circumstances, which are our common law negligence claim?
Well, the higher standard of duty. Because, quite frankly, it's grab what you can in regular contract law. And fiduciary law isn't like that. You have a higher duty. You have to disclose information. You can't say, I'm not going to tell you that. That's not the way trustees are held to a higher standard. And that's what fiduciary duty law is all about. Is you can't say, gotcha, to your beneficiary. And that's, in fact, what happened here.
Okay. Thank you.
As I read the Court of Appeals decision, it said the allegation was negligence. And then it said that despite the fact that the allegations are all negligent, the Roy Corporation said that a breach of the fiduciary duty is an intentional tort, subject to 89357. They then said they were a little confused about Hatterberg because Hatterberg was a negligence case, too. But that Hatterberg talked about the fiduciary duty included a duty of care, which Judge Bergeron and her colleagues says that would confuse things and that this court would not have intended to confuse things without directly addressing it. And that to, they say Beloit is controlling because it says flat out all trust is intentional 2 years. We recognize that Hattleburg in the context raises a question. In addition, the argument based on to the person in 89357 raises an issue that would benefit from further consideration. However, those issues must be addressed to the court. Which issues are you raising?
All of those. No intent, no injury to the person, and the Hattleburg holding, which I think our holding should not be interpreted as encouraging trustees and financial professionals to remain silent rather than risk providing false information to their clients.
If we hold for you, do we have to reverse Beloit?
No, because this is an express trust. In Beloit, the claims, I listened to the oral arguments, the claims were all intentional acts. I've read the briefs in the case. I've read the court's opinion. Beloit is an intentional acts case because that's the only way a plaintiff can prevail in a claim against a corporate officer and director. So you don't have to reverse that case. What you have to do is have it find a separate finding for express trust because express trust can involve negligent acts by the trustee in breach of their fiduciary duty. Can and do.
And what's your authority for that?
Hattleburg, McCoy, I went through Production Association versus Vodak. There's several of them cited in the brief.
Okay.
Noonan is another one. Hamas.
So you're going to have negligent failure to comply with your fiduciary duty. That's your position.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to all the counsel, Mr. Demmett and Mr. Schreiner, for their excellent arguments today and a very interesting case, one that has come up a number of times. That concludes our hearing in Z4-04-18-276, Astro versus Journal Communications.